session number 25054-013.
Derek Plummer, Reel 13. So, how long were you in Taiwan altogether?
Again, about 2 years ago.
About 2 years.
Yes.
Yeah. So, were there any particular incidents that happened while you were there?
No. It was
fairly
all
routine,
yes. Yeah. I was free to do what I pleased, go where I pleased, within the restrictions imposed upon me, but it was a pleasant life.
Was it? It didn't get boring?
Oh, no, anything but. You see, there were no tourists, and there was a tiny hotel called The Grand, which was anything but grand, ghastly little place. And tourists, thank God, didn't arrive. That all followed afterwards. I was telling you the other day that the main force there was the military advisory group, MAG, of the Americans, which was in excess of 10,000 people.
Really?
And like the Americans always do, they built themselves married quarters, swimming pools, bowling alleys, all the things that they go with it, a huge PX and a commissary. Which they, I'm not going to run them down too much. I was allowed to use their PX and the commissary. Also, the embassy shop, I had access to that, which was all very useful.
So even though you were persona non grata to them, really?
In a way. And they had a huge, not unlike us, they had a huge mess for all the officers in the middle of Taipei. It was called the USUMT, which stood for United States Officers Open Mess Taiwan. If you put that all together, you get USUMPT. And it was rather like a motorway service station without the petrol. It wasn't like a normal mess. You walk through to being automatic doors which opened because it was so hot there, and you walk through a great a corridor of people either side of you playing these one-armed bandits, money dropping on the floor all the time, people swearing because they'd missed $1 million, whatever. It was dreadful. And then you walked onto an ice-cold bar, and then off the bar there's a huge dining room. It must have seated 200 people quite easily. And there was one smaller dining room somewhere else. Now, I was made an honorary member of this mess, so I was a member of USUMPT, and it was very, very good of them to let me do that, because there was nowhere else to eat if you were in town. It was in... I couldn't go home every time, 14 miles down and get the car. And there was quite a lot of entertainment there in the evenings. But they were cautious. My closest friends, they were all the American attaches. There was a military attache, four of them, colonel, half-colonel, major and captain. There was a naval attaché. The captain of the Navy. It was Nelson, Captain Nelson. And a commander, lieutenant commander, and a lieutenant, and the Air Force had four. So there were 12 in the attaché office. And they were my contacts. And but they didn't give me much information. Only one of them did. Mm-hmm. But any parties or anything like that, they were the people I would sort of end up with.
And you went over to Hong Kong every fortnight?
No, I didn't. Someone did. We took it in turns. There were five of us. Okay. Had to spend the night over there to collect the incoming bag in the morning with the Queen's Courier who turned up.
Right. So did you get much of a look at Hong Kong then?
Oh, yes, I did. I loved it. I'd stayed in a small hotel. You could stay where you like that night. I had a little town. I think it was called the Four Seasons or something like that. But the diplomatic bag always went to the peninsula. So then the mezzanine floor there, it was a sort of secret place, I think. You had to go up there to collect and to deliver. And it was all behind bars and padlocks and everything.
Did it seem quite exciting all this?
Yes, I loved it. The only trouble going over there with the bag was that you always had a shopping list requirement for all the other people in the consulate there. You know, seeds, sunflower seeds or something for the garden of the consul, and that sort of thing. The consul was a lovely building. It was a fort, a red sandstone fort, right on the sea, high up on a clifftop. It was built by the Portuguese about 400 or 500 years earlier, yes. It had the only grass tennis court in the island. And Mrs. Veach, who was really an absolute bitch, she wouldn't allow anyone to use it. She wanted it as grass and not as a tennis court. So no one played tennis there. The only golf course in the island was in this little village, too. The village was called Tam Sui, I live in. Or Tam Sui, whichever you like to call it. We always called it Tam Sui. Which is tiny, knowing no Europeans of any sort there at all, apart from the consul staff. And it was a lovely, beautiful river there. At the mouth there, it was a mile and a half wide, and we looked right across to an extinct volcano, just like a child would draw a volcano. But it was rather sad. At the base of it, it was a leper colony. Mm-hmm. Yes, I went over there to see it once and talked to them. Mm-hmm. It's awfully sad, isn't it? But they were pleased to see you.
Yeah.
Well, not many people went. It was a hell of a long way. It was 15 miles up to Taipan and about 20 miles the other side down to get back just opposite, the mile and a half away from where I lived.
And did Chiang Kai-shek do anything for the people of Taiwan?
No, I don't think so. I don't think
sheltered
so.
Sheltered there, really.
Yes, really. And he headed up what he hoped to be a powerful government. Half the world recognised him, a half didn't.
Mm.
We had a wicked son called... God, I even forgot his name. He was head of a sort of secret police army, in the army. He was a general, needless to say, and he was Chiang was may have been cruel, but he never appeared or never gave you any indication he was issuing orders that were cruel in a way. But this son was wicked, wicked man.
Mm.
He was there at that extraordinary dinner party too.
Yeah. Okay, so you had your wife and child.
Yes.
Yeah. So 2 years there, and then back to
and I said, as I still lived in Southampton, I said, can I take back that job as naval movements? And I did that for a very short time.
Yeah.
And finally they caught up with me and said, you've done that job too long. And at that point, I don't know the year, and I tell you it was at the time of the Profumo scandal.
Oh.
And that's when I was sent for by Mountbatten and asked whether I'd do this job for him.
So you gave up your post in Southampton?
Yes.
And where did you move to then? Tell me first of all, Mountbatten, where had you met Mountbatten? He knew you...
Only when I was in command operations once. He didn't know me at all, but he obviously went to the appointers and said he wanted a lieutenant commander, B, someone who was able to entertain and look after people of a foreign nature, you know, foreign people, of course, and who hadn't got a job which was all that important, I assume. And they must have given him a list, because he had an admiral as a secretary, and he told me all this and said, you know, he's been through about four final names and has wanted to see you first, and he never asked for anyone else. I took it straight away. He was then chief of the defense staff, not just the first sea lord, he was chief of the defense staff, and very busy bloke. And
he called you to him,
yeah.
And where did you meet him?
In Admiralty,
yeah.
Yes. And
what was your first impression?
Very favourable. He was very kind indeed. He said, I expect you'll need a drink. And I said, I will. And he said, I didn't know what he got. He said, I thought he was going to be tea or coffee. And he went and opened up a cupboard with all the... And we had a brandy or something each, horse's neck probably. And he said, told me exactly what he wanted. And said, I have no idea how you're going to do it, but they'll be here for a month. I want you to meet them and to see them off at the end. And in between, you've got a wet nurse, these 80. And he said, told me what the makeup was. He said, I've got an office down here, just two or three doors away, which will equip for whoever does the job. You've got a secretary, all the books in the world you want to do the job. Would you now go and spend the rest of the day looking at that, thinking about it, and come back and tell me this evening what you think? And I went back in the evening and I said, yes, I can do it. And I said, one thing though, I think I need a second officer, because the Iranians won't be able to, I won't understand a word, they'll be very limited. So he said, so you want an Iranian interpreter? And I said, yes. He said, that'll be done. And he said, in that case, if you could start next week. And he said, we'll wait for you, the answer. And he said, take a week of making the plan and bring it to me and we'll go through it together. And by that time, he'd got me a flight lieutenant who was an Iranian speaker, which is good. And we worked through it. We phoned up every naval establishment, every air establishment, every army establishment in the British Isles and everybody else we could think of. And I decided immediately it was silly to taking 80 officers together. We would never find accommodation anywhere for 80 people. So I decided we'd split them in two. The senior ones I'd take, the junior ones the flight lieutenant would take. We would go clockwise around England, he would go anti-clockwise around England, and we'd meet up right at London for the final 2 days.
So what did Mountbatten tell you was the purpose? What were you actually trying to do with all these people? And who were they?
Acquaint them with England, familiarise them. And to
who were these people? They were the
Pakistanis, his military, army, or military, navy, army and air force.
There was one representative from each country, was there?
No, only three countries. There were 80 people in all.
Right, so, and the countries were Pakistan,
Turkey, and Iran.
Iran, right. So what was the Senate of?
They were in this union called CENTO, which eventually, after that, disbanded, I think. It's like NATO, but it was Central European Nations. So it was a military agreement. We would each help the other in time of war.
So what was Britain's? Were we going to be a member of this?
We were a member, yes. The four people were England and these three, CENTO. And it was originally, I think, Mountbatten's idea. It was his baby. And this, I think, was an attempt to keep the baby going a bit longer, which was dying. And my job was to take them around, keep them entertained, amused, and interested. Nothing technical at all. So I went, for instance, we went on board Victory in Portsmouth. I managed, luckily, to find a Canadian cruiser when we got down to Portsmouth. So I altered the plan and arranged a cocktail party on board, the quarter deck of a cruiser. And we went down to all the military, army, and we flew with the Air Force. We learnt the preliminary stage of parachute jumping with the RAF at Oxfordshire. And then they had a place at Abingdon there where they did all the parachute jumping. And went to all these places. Mess dinners in gunnery schools on Salisbury Plain. Occasionally we had differences of opinion, but it went very well indeed. We went to Mountbatten's house twice with cocktails out on the grass at Rumsey.
Did you see Mountbatten again?
Yes. I saw him two or three times. He joined us just at his house, for instance, which was 2 days after we started this going around clockwise. And the other, I hoped my flight lieutenant was doing as well, going the other way around. It all ended in disaster. When we got back, the topical conversation at that time, of course, was Profumo and all the Cleveland, whatever it was. None of these people had ever let me forget it. And, of course, the Pakistanis had all been trained. They were all senior officers, generals. They'd all been trained in England. They knew England better than I did. And they all had women they'd been sleeping with all over England. So it's a hell of a job. It's like keeping dogs together. Turn one way and one of them would disappear. And you appear next day and he said, very sorry, you know, a friend of mine used to live in a house up there. And you understand, don't you? But right at the end, we agreed, the final was, we couldn't find any hotel other than Charing Cross, which would take the lot. Very nice hotel indeed. And I could get all 80 in there for the last 2 days. And with Mountbatten's approval, he gave us access to the, where are the Chelsea pensioners? The hospital, isn't it?
The Royal Hospital of Chelsea.
Yeah. There was a huge room there, and we were going to have all of them there together. They were going to come in busloads, 80 of them, walk into the entrance there where I would be standing with Mountbatten, and I should know all 80 names without looking at a paper and introduce them to him as they came in. Then I was going to be drinking until half past 7, 8 o'clock, then a sort of buffet supper, and then all going back to the hotel saying goodbye to Mountbatten and that. And it didn't work because I couldn't do the 40 belonging to the junior ones, so I got the flight lieutenant to introduce them. I did all the senior ones. Whether they were all right names or not, I don't know. Mountbatten certainly didn't know, so it didn't matter. And then all that was done, and he's then said, well, I'm going to circulate. And he called me Derek all the time, which was very nice. I didn't think he would. And then about half an hour later, he came over to me, and he said, look, I can't stand this any longer. He said, I've got to sit down. So he said, I've arranged for a table to be laid in a small room there. And he said, go and find the 10 senior officers and tell them they're having supper with me sitting down, not a bloody buffet. So I said, right. And I suddenly remembered, I said, sir, if we do that, there won't be any Iranians. He said, why not? I said, because the Iranian's senior officer is junior to he'd be about 10th or 12th or 13th down the list. He won't be in the first 10. He said, forget it then. So just forget the Iranians, just have the other two locked. So I told the top five in the Turks and top five of the Pakistanis, who were glad to go and join the Admiral. It was lovely and a great honour. About 10 seconds later, the senior Iranian general came to me and said, why wasn't he there? So I explained what had happened. And he said, this is an insult to the Shah. And I said, no, it's not. I said, this is the way he wants it. And, you know, in the services, we do what you're told. And I said, he hasn't given an order to you. He's just asked the other two to join, the other two countries. And he said, I'm sorry, I'm not accepting it. So I got hold of the Mountbatten's admiral, who's a huge man, much bigger than Todd, lovely man. He was his secretary. He was also an admiral. Because, you know, when you're a secretary to an admiral and he gets promoted, you get promoted. And he gets promoted again, you get promoted. So he'd gone through all the stages of promotion. And he was an admiral himself, but not, of course, an admiral of the fleet, as Mountbatten was. And he said, look, this is bad. I'll go and tell the boss. So he went through and he came back. He said, sorry, he's absolutely adamant. He's not going to give way. So I said, well, we're going to have trouble. And half an hour later, the Iranian boss came to me and said, we are leaving. We're going back to the hotel. So I said, well, I get the transport. He said, we don't want transport. He said, we're not worthy of transport. I said, well, we can't walk all the way back. He said, we're walking. So I said, do you want someone to come with you? He said, nope, we'll ask the way. So they disappeared. I then told my band, he said, tell the monks they can do what they please. He was furious about this. Late at night, we went back by bus, the rest of us. And when I got to the hotel, in the sort of foyer there, was all the luggage of the Iranians, and they were all there, and they'd stripped themselves of all their badge rank. They all looked like just, you couldn't tell what rank they were. All the pips and stripes had been removed. The whole lot. And I said, what the hell are you doing? Why aren't you turned in? He said, we're not using the beds. We are not worthy of that. We're staying down here. We shall spend the night here. So I said, okay, it's up to you entirely. Next morning, we all got in the buses. We went down to, which airport would it be now? Not the main one.
Gatwick. London. Gatwick. Northwood. RAF one.
No, it wasn't RAF. It was civil air.
So Gatwick or Heathrow.
I think it was Gatwick.
Croydon,
I think it was Gatwick. That was the lesser of the two. Wasn't Heathrow was the main. Yeah, it was Gatwick. We went down. There were two RAF Transport Command viceroys, or whatever they were called, the push-pull engines, were ready to take them. One for the seniors, one for the junior. So we got there, and I started telling them which ones they go to, and the Iranians said they were all going together because we'd insulted the Shah. And they were going together. We are no longer subject to your commands and wishes. We're going to do what we want to. So they all walked together to one aircraft and got in hours before NASA, and there they stuck. So the secretary had turned up by then, and I told him what had happened. He said, oh, God. So he got on the phone to Mountbatten. Mountbatten said, don't let them go. I'll be down there in 20 minutes. He arrived by helicopter. He said, quickly tell me what's happened, Eric. And I told him. He said, right, don't come with me. He's rushed across the tarmac to the one with the Iranians in. The rest I got out. I wouldn't let him go. They were all waiting in some sort of lounge. And he disappeared inside. And we were taking bets on how long he'd be before he reappeared. It was about 10 minutes later, he reappeared. And behind him, like the Pied Piper, he was bringing all the rats. He came out. Yes, they came out. I got to know. That's why he said, don't come
up. He let it go for such a long time.
I know. And he came over and he said, they're going to restore their rank and they're going to obey the orders. We've got the senior ones here and the junior ones. And they disappeared. And he went back in his helicopter. And that was the last time I ever saw him. I had a letter from him, and a very nice letter from the admiral saying, you know, what a wonderful job that we'd done for it. It was an absolute nonsense. It was a terrible thing to do. It really was.
Yeah.
He should. I mean, I did. I was quick enough.
That sort of a man.
I think so. I think he. Yes, he didn't like being corrected. When I said, you know, that we can't do that, that upset him. I think. Of course, he could do anything, and he knew it. But he should have listened then.
Yes. Yeah.
Well, that was it.
With retrospect, what do you think of Mountbatten? You've heard all sorts of things. Was he a sort of? I know a little. Almost little.
Yes.
I imagine he was a bit of in a way, of a very competent chancellor. You know,
he was a very competent officer, very competent, but I think he used the fact that he was so close to royalty, and royalty himself.
Traded on
yes. I'm glad I never served with him. I wouldn't like to be in a destroyer with him, and he was a destroyer man. Mm. I don't think I would want to serve with him.
Because?
Because I think he was in so many ways, I was going to say a mental bully, but I think he pressurized people, knowing he was always going to get his way. Mm. And he wasn't always right. He made mistakes like the rest of us. Mm. But he would never believe that. He was always right. Anyway, during those couple of months I was doing that, I found him nothing but helpful.
Right, yes.
But it was wonderful having a trump card. If there was any argument with anybody else, I only had to mention Mark Batten,
right,
and the argument was over.
Yeah. And did he meet his wife? Was it Edwina?
Interesting. Mm. At this time, she was dead.
Right.
But I was... Because I was a serviceman and I was in a country that no one else could get into in Formosa, I looked after Navy, Army, Air Force intelligence, and there was a big air attaches meeting in Singapore, which I was invited to, because they couldn't come out, no one could come into, well, they weren't allowed into Formosa. No one was allowed there, no British, except myself and the consul, and Robinson. And I was asked if I would go down and speak for about 20 minutes on the work I was doing out there, which wasn't work at all. It was very easy to talk for 20 minutes on nothing. And I went down there and we had a very pleasant dinner first night. And then we talked, or listening to talk all day. And next day, a bit more talk, and I did my talk. In the evening, there was a huge reception, and the governor's, who was an Air Chief Marshal, and I can't remember what his name was, lovely government house. I'd never been there, in Singapore's government house. Huge lawns, and all lit up because it was nighttime. Lovely. And nothing to do with the air attaches meeting. We listened to all sorts of talk, very interesting. I think they received mine with a reasonable amount of enthusiasm. But at the party was Lady Mountbatten and an aide of hers. She was doing a tour of the world of first aid of Red Cross. She was in Singapore and she was going on to, I forget which country, the next night. The ADC came over to me and said, as you're the only naval person here, there are about 100 people, at least 100 there, said the only naval person, would you like to come over and meet Lady Mountbatten? I said, yes, I'd love to. And so I was introduced to her. And I couldn't take my eyes off, first of all, her triple choker of real pearls, the size of grapes. You've never seen it. And the other thing I couldn't take my eyes off was her skin, which was like a very ancient prehistoric animal. When she talked, it all opened up and closed like a bit. It was... You could almost lose yourself in the wrinkles.
Really?
Plastered with makeup. Must have been put on with a sort of cement trowel. It was so thick. Other than that, absolutely marvellous. And after about an hour, I said, you know, I really must give other people a chance. I said, you're not going. She grabbed me by the arm. She said, you're going to stay here. And I stayed with her on that lawn the whole night until the party packed up. She was sweet. I heard an awful lot of things that I think I shouldn't have heard. She hadn't anyone else to talk to. I mean, a lot of people came around, she talked to them. But she always turned to me in the end, and people disappeared. And she that was it. I said goodnight to her. At the end, she went off with her assistant. I don't know what you'll have called her. She was an elderly woman, the other one. And so was Lady Mountbatten. Mm-hmm. And the next thing, I was flown back by Cathay Pacific, I think it was, in Hong Kong. And the news came through that she had died.
Oh, really?
That was 2 days later.
Oh, really?
So I had met her, and I did tell Mountbatten that when I was working for him. I told him that I was probably the last person in the Navy to speak to, and he was very interested in that.
Mm.
But of course, it had been a fairly dicey marriage for a long, long time.
Mm. Yes, they
both had their own ideas.
So after the episode working for Mountbatten, Where to then?
I went to my penultimate appointment, which is the naval chemical, biological chemical establishment, Phoenix, HMS Phoenix. And I was appointed there as the training officer and senior instructor. Mm-hmm. And what I knew about chemical warfare, I could put on the back of a penny postage stamp. I knew nothing at all about it. So I...
So what were they doing? What was
well, it was a time when nuclear weapons were considered to be... the next war would be nuclear. All ships were... No ship in my time was equipped to cope with a nuclear explosion. We were turning our ships into sort of... gas-proof and bomb-proof, not bomb-proof, but fallout-proof. And we introduced a thing into the Navy called spraying, with the ship, the whole ship, you could make one switch, was covered in water. We had jets all over the upper deck spraying, pouring salt water from the sea over the ship so that when fallout arrived, which is a dust, a powder, it would be washed away. This was a wonderful invention. It was done by the... this particular school. Then we invented the thing which is giving the army so much trouble now, of course it's so hot, clothes that you could wear during gas attack, which are impervious to chemical agents and things like that. It gave rise to Velcro, which was the only way you could seal this coat. Buttons, of course, stuff would be able to get in. So with Velcro was invented up at Porton Down, which we work closely with, you see. And it was all to do with that sort of thing. Mm. I knew nothing about it at all, but I learnt.
Right, so when you arrived, you had to be taught.
Yes, I was taught by taking... I had a month with the chap I was taking over from, who was the Navy's expert, and I went everywhere he went, listening to him talking day and night, and I got it parrot fashion, so I was limited. Of course, there must have been things I hadn't heard, and I got over that by lecturing, and when someone asked me a question I didn't know, I would say, now, what would you do? To another bloke, you see. Anyone know what the answer to this? They didn't know, I didn't know. They thought I was questioning, but you learn very, very quickly. Mm. And you soon get away with it. You become past master asking questions.
Where was HMS Venus?
In Portsmouth, right. Almost at the top of Portsmouth. It was worked with the gunnery school, which I hated. But we were a sort of part of the gunnery school. It was a separate establishment, separate. But if I wanted lunch at lunchtime, which I never did, you would have to go down by car to the naval, the gunnery school, and get a meal there. We were members of that mess. Mm.
And who was coming to have your go through your?
Everybody in the Navy, in turn.
And how long was it?
You started with. I'd had an admiral's course, which was one day, because they didn't want to know much. They knew nothing, and they wanted to go away knowing nothing. Which from time to time we'd have a few admirals. They were very interested, but they didn't stay long. Most of the courses were for junior rates were about a week. For senior rates, they were either a fortnight or a month. For officers, they were a fortnight or a month, and then some people stayed a bit longer and did a sort of 2 or 3 months course. Mm-hmm. There was an awful lot to tell them, but you had to believe that what you were being taught was likely. A lot of it seemed improbable. But it all seemed so remote from what life was like at the time. It was a lot to do with chemical warfare and biological warfare. And, of course, the bomb had been dropped, and we knew all about that. That was the only thing that would seem much more likely. That's why we invented all these things to make a ship safe. And when people went out with Geiger counters and to see what the strength of the... radiation was outside. When they came back, they'd be covered, so we had to go through a process of stripping off and all the clothes being washed and so on. Very interesting indeed. And a lot of the time I had to go down from Portsmouth to Portland, where ships were putting the things we were dealing into action, and they were trying them out there at sea. So I had to go down for a day, go out all day on a frigate or a destroyer. Destroyers were being faded out by then, but there were still a few, mostly frigates. We'd go out and see if all this pre-wetting, what they called it, was running, and teach people. And then in the evening, I come back, drive back to Portsmouth. So,
okay, I'll stop you there. Derek Plummer, end of reel 13.